such an assistant that you advocate, is that it should be a worldwide movement. However, as we're, I'm sure, quite aware, in each country in the world, people are at different states of awareness. Therefore, say, for example, Britain was ready for a change to socialism, perhaps countries like Russia or Czechoslovakia may not be. Have you an answer for this?
Well, first of all, I mean, today capitalism is pretty international. It's virtually all over the world.
I think, though, that perhaps in the communist countries this isn't so.
Well, we wouldn't call them communist countries. We would call them state capitalist countries. You're possibly thinking of places like Russia or China or, you know, these places what's referred to as behind the curtain. You're thinking of those sort of
things.
Well, as far as we're concerned, there is capitalism there. There's a different type of capitalism. It's state capitalism. But it's there. But I possibly could give you an illustration that the trade union movement started in this country. And within 40 years, it had virtually spread all over, you know, the world, you know, the industrial world. You see, ideas don't just arise in one country and not in another. I mean, they're sort of virtually international. Organisation, and already the Socialist Party has companion parties in a number of countries. You know? But as I say, I can't see any real, you know, any problem in it at all. I mean, I'll give you the best example. It just strikes me. I used to be in the power industry, and we had a problem. The trade unions in the power industry. Every time we worked a rule, they used to send power over from France on a line. Right? They did it once, and we were beaten. The second time, we thought about it, we went over to London. I'm not an educated bob. I couldn't speak French. We went across the French trade unions, and we spouted out what it meant. And you know, before long, we actually had a gathering of shop stewards from most of the continental countries to discuss a common problem, to fight a common enemy. You know what I mean? Now, that was due to, just to the fact that we realised we got to do it. In this moment in time, the power industry, one of the things that where is the power cuts in such as a work to rule in Belfast happens, you've got to have the support of your fellow trade unionists in air. You need the support of your fellow trade unionists here. Now, that's one instance. Something that was on the TV the other week, very moving portrayal. A life for Alice. Since that's happened, there has been 4 union meetings talking about asbestos workers in other countries. You know, right away, people respond pretty rapidly. So, I mean, this sort of thing would, you know.
I agree with what you say in so much as that there is a general state of awareness in the capitalist countries, so-called. But I still feel that there is a large gap in the awareness between these countries and the Eastern Bloc.
What do you think is happening in Poland? What's happening in Poland? I mean, there's a case. You've got trade unions there fighting for the very bare rights to organise, to this, that, and the other. And they're forced to do this. You know, I mean, they've been forced to do this. And I think the same is how a friend of mine worked for an oil company. He was over in China a bit ago. You know, they're now bringing their lot of American know-how into China, as they call it. And he was telling me about how there already are unofficial movements in China among the trade unionists. Already. And for all we know, this is going on in Russia. I showed some Russians around Manchester, showed them around where Engels used to be, and where Marx was, where the Industrial Revolution occurred. You know? And it was incredible. They saw eye to eye with me about tons of things. Eye to eye with me about tons of things. They were talking, because I'd formerly been in the parliament, so we were talking about the problems of our workers. You know, I mean, we were identical in what we were saying virtually. What should be done, how it should be done, this, that, and the other. Now, that wasn't the official state, you know, trade union. They were members of it, but by Christ, they were thinking differently. So this is it, you see. I don't think it's right to presume that because we feel that we know a little bit more and the other fellow doesn't, you're often surprised when you go across and find he knows a damn sight more, as it were, than we do.
What I got to say, in 1972, there was a lot of strike waves in China.
What was there? Never. Surely it must be up there, sir. Which side is the main question?
Perhaps I could ask one more simple question. At what stage does a worker become a capitalist?
Do you want things in niche compartments? Presumably you do.
No, I realise that there are a range, but you seem to be stating two sides. There are either workers or there are capitalists, but there are many, a certain percentage of the population, which are somewhere in between.
Can I ask you a simple question?
Yes.
At what stage does green become blue? In other words, for our convenience, we split up seven colours of the spectrum, right? And we can chop the graph of wealth ownership more or less where we like to mean what we like. There are all sorts of chops to the graph. It doesn't alter the fact that the very large percentage of the population have no alternative but to go and offer themselves to an employer. A very small percentage of the population constitute those employers. Now, it's quite true that there is movement up and down between those two classes. There are some of the children of capitalists who lose their money for one reason or another and descend into the ranks of the workers. There are some workers who manage to get seats on a board and happen to buy a few shares according to a preferential deal and start to be able to, if they want to, live on their capital. That's a distinguishing thing. Can a person, if he or she wants to, live on the capital they've got and the rent or profit or interest that it returns? If they can't live on it, if they're still forced to sell themselves to a capitalist, then they're workers. Agreed. There is a grey area in between. The point is that the grey area is quite narrow. The size of the working class is immense.
Does that answer your question? I think it does. I possibly would have to think some more
Is there anybody else? Questions for the speakers?
How would you direct your arguments for democratic socialism to a rich man? Who? Now, I can understand you've given your arguments to a Labour supporter, say, of the Labour Party, because most of them have very little to lose in terms of wealth. But a rich man has got a lot to lose, even though he might think socialism is a good idea. Now, he's got a lot to lose, so he thinks, oh no, it's too much to risk. If it doesn't work, I've lost it. Now, what argument would you give him, would you approach him with the same, you know, the same approach as you would to a poor man, I think?
I prefer your first question. What argument would you address? And the answer probably would be none at all. You see, this revolution has got to be accomplished by the working class. By and large, the capitalist class will not be responsible for accomplishing it. It doesn't alter the fact that there may be a few of them who do take part in it. That's neither here nor there. The force in society is the working class. Those are the ones that we're addressing our remarks to. Now, if you had said, I'm really framing a better question for you, if you had said, how do you address a rather well-paid member of the working class, that's a much more knotty question. And if you want me to address that one, I will.
Yeah, that's what I was...
That's what you were really meaning.
Yeah.
Very much as we've talked tonight, I would say, you see, while he was dealing with capitalism, pointed out the fact that capitalism is a very badly organised, very dangerous, very destructive system of society. It's a question of asking a well-paid member of the working class how he rates his chances. Is he going to stay a well-paid member of the working class to begin with? And fortunes are highly dubious. There's an enormous number of managers or well-paid, in quotes, professional people have come on the job market, as well as a lot of lathe operators and drillers, and dressers and all the rest of it. They are just subject to the economic climate as any lower-paid member of the working class. So how do they rate their chances in capitalism, first of all? And secondly, how do they rate the chances of capitalism itself? I can't remember estimates of the number of TNT equivalent tons there are per member of the human race present stockpiled, but they're pretty immense, and I can't remember how much nerve gas it takes to finish us all off. You get the general picture that I'm drawing. In other words, the argument I would address to a well-paid member of the working class is, do you think that that there's a chance for very much longer with this system of society?
Well, I think the answer is no. If they maintain it for much longer, it's going to be the end of them.
Regardless of how much pay, then what happens to the hats and the suits and the two or three girlfriends or whatever?
I come across an emotion rather than the book, although it's called Fortune. I recently come across them on a copy of the American magazine Fortune. And it points out there that big firms like General Motors, Chrysler, and the aircraft manufacturers, and all the big, the top names in the American industry, they were kind of back, not on production workers, but on the managerial level.
We can see this in the hospital service. I mean, if you'd have said a year ago, I'm convener of a hospital, and we've got our consultants going around with petitions to the visitors. The consultants, the actual acme of perfection in a hospital, the people that nurses and all these sort of people are allegedly to look at. Now there they are going around asking patients, visitors to sign petitions. We have doctors on a shop stewards committee. A year ago, in the winter of discontent that the Labour government was in, that was impossible. It seems now that these people are starting to realise that they're not as secure as they used to be. They're not as secure, there's cuts for consultants as there is for porters. And they're starting to realise that let's just stick together, they're up, you know. And this is something that's happening. It is inconceivable, as I say, to anybody of a year ago, just as it is inconceivable to anybody of my age, who lived in the 30s, in the hungry 30s, to think in a period of high unemployment that people would take a day off in support of an industry that they're only related to by trade union connection. It was impossible in the 30s today to start making it a fact of life. That hundreds of thousands of people gave a day's pay to support somebody. This is a wonderful bloody thing. It's a wonderful thing. It should give the socialists strength, hope and bloody inspiration. It shows that there's some solidarity. It is a remarkable thing. And this is something that was inconceivable. I find, the people tell me I'm an optimist, but I find that among professional people, educated people, you know, these sort of people in the professions in the hospitals are now far more militant than some of the manual workers. It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, this is something that... I mean, I gasp with astonishment at times. I actually gasp with astonishment at the difference in attitude in virtually within a couple of years. It's really surprising. Really surprising. Something, as I say, that was inconceivable. And I think that capitalism is forcing people. I came down on the train today, and invariably when I'm on the train, I'm a socialist, so I'm always talking about socialism. So three standards on the train. Oh yes, talk to people. And I was talking to a woman with a son who just left the university. She was telling me he couldn't get a job, what a terrible thing it was. And two other people joined in the little get-along. But the thing was, at one time they said, shut up, you're a nutter. Today they were interesting. I said, oh, yes, there's something in what you're saying. It's a bad thing, you know, when people have gone to university and can't get a job, you know. You know, and if you talk to people on the buses and this sort of thing, I suggest, and I humbly suggest, every member should always have a standard in his pocket when he's out. You know? In Manchester, people often say to me, what are you talking to him for? Or what are you talking to him in the pub for? Because I'm talking to them because they are susceptible today to socialist ideas which they weren't a year or two ago. They were not a year or two ago. It's very significant. Very significant to me that Foote didn't address this year's TUC conference. There is a considerable body of people. people in the trade union movement, the rank and file, who are not very enthusiastic about the Labour Party. I kid you not. I kid you not. I moved a resolution last year to remove political levy for the Lancashire Newpee. And it was removed. It took them all the wangling and fiddling to get the bloody thing sacked this year. There is a dissolution. You know, maybe I'm a little... maybe my voice, like the case, is a little strong. But I say to you that, seriously, there is more hope today than there has been in a number of years. And this isn't some figment of my imagination or something out of my dreams or the longing. I've been involved in the struggle a long, long time. And I find it far easier to put across ideas today than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if you want, 40 years ago, and more. I find it far more easy. Far more easier indeed. 1939, I went to Manchester University and asked the students, a fellow by the name of Sir Philip Manson Barr was the president of the union. And he said to me, this fellow, he said, now what do you want? So I said, well, you see, there's some of the engineering apprentices on strike. We were wondering if you people could help us. Oh, no, no, he said, old fellow, he said, you see, this is a university, we're above all that type of thing. 1971, I took £6,500 out of the complex of Manchester University to give up the minor. The biggest campus in Europe is in Manchester. And we took £6,500 in collection from those students. They did every bloody thing that was conceivable to assist the minors. What a change, what a change, what a change. You can't get a job as a bloody lecturer today unless you're a trendy left.
I go on, but believe you me.
So, question, criticism, comment?
I'd like to ask Molly a question. If walking around with this socialist standard, or even talking about socialism, were you ever approached by a fascist? And if you were, what happened,
Well, I have been. I'm old enough to remember the Oswald Mosley and the fascist movement when they used to go around shouting Britain for the Britons and Spain for the Germans.
Do you know?
I remember those times. You do get. I tell you something that's well worth thinking about. And I think it's worth people in the party knowing. I went to Bolton meeting a couple of years ago and Comrade Bannock was speaking. And in Bolton, there are quite a large section of the National Front. And the most incredible thing was that these young fellows had come in, these National Front, with the intent to smash the meeting. And Comrade Manny handled it very well. And you've got to understand that up in Scotland, there is no National Front, there's the Orange Men. It's the same meat, different gravy version. Anyway. And he handled it, and the incredible thing was that within the time the meeting was up, these young people were actually arguing about socialism, that they'd come to smash the meeting up and go to the NWP or something. And it was quite surprising. It was quite surprising, the differences that had occurred. You know, when they could found that they could put their point of view, I mean, all the sort of rubbish that they believe, you know what I mean? One thought that when you went to the social security relation, they immediately gave you a TV. Once you come up against it, and they got into it, it was surprising how different they were. And when you really got down to it, you said, well, why are you in the National Front? Well, they said, you see, it's the only way that there's any future for me. I can get a job and hear this crowd do it, and all this sort of thing. But it's quite surprising. I've never yet... The only people I've ever been injured with are not National Front, on the country of the Communist Party. I once remember being really physically hurt by the Communists at a meeting. I was convened of a place, they actually threw me off the platform a month in. Possibly you want to do the same, would happen. That's fair tonight. So it's not the fascist. And something happened here the last time I was here. And I want to make this because I've gone to considerable trouble. There was a statement made here that in Lancashire, members of the National Front were in union positions. Now, I've written to every union. I've seen every union secretary. I know most of them personally. And that is not so. There is no National Front member, as far as language is concerned, holding any union position. So I want to make that clear, because I consider that was a reflection on the trade unions in the area where I'm from. So that was definitely wrong. There is no substance for that. You can take that from me. Point of fact, most of the people in the National Front are rather disillusioned, misguided sort of people. But I've never had really any trouble with them at all. Not at all. No. No. The one thing they fear is anybody who can say, well, you put your point of view. And once it's like the hecklers at the meeting, they say, come on, brother, you've got plenty to say down there, come on the platform, and they suddenly shut up, you know.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, when I've spoken to Labour Party, you know, left-wingers and SWPs and that, and their attitude towards fascists or anybody with a skinhead even is, ooh, it's bad news, you know. What have you talked to him? In this bloke might be British Rumour and National Front. It's obvious, you know, they joined a political party to try to better his country or his own situation. You know, he wants to do something. So why not talk with him and reason with him? And maybe he might find the best way, you know?
It's worth saying, by the way, that of course, I don't know how the SWP or some left can say they oppose him. How the hell did they don't oppose the National Front at all? They agreed with the National Front over the common market. They agreed with the National Front over import controls, one thing another. Oh, yes, they agree with them.
Yeah. I was reading a bit of Trotsky literature one time, and it's with the German occupation. There might have been one group of Trotskyists that were going around trying to convert the German soldiers. So the case is, that could happen, a similar case, if you had a similarity with the Socialist Party of Great Britain in France trying to do the same. Instead of going out fighting them like as partigans, I'm trying to convert them.
On that point, since it's been touched upon, it is worth remembering that, and there's quite a bit of evidence for this, that the largest number of victims, or one of the largest single groups of victims of the French underground movement, in which by the later years of the war, the communist, that's just not real communist, but the Communist Party was a major force in the French underground movement. One of the largest numbers of victims were groups in the French labour movement who belonged to a tradition which hardly exists in England, that is, of people who are, to some extent, Marxists, but who never went over to the Communist Party and stayed in the French equivalent, the Labour Party. And these people took an attitude during the German occupation which was, well, it's capitalism anyway, and we've got to resist it irrespective. And they had some sort of trade union organisation, and they had some sort of negotiations, and the communists bumped off an extremely high proportion of this element of the French labour movement, so that the picture that you have of these people resisting fascists at all costs wasn't quite the picture. It was very often bumping off people who saw through their particular falsification of Marxian ideas. And just another aspect which you'll forgive me, a visitor here from Colombia reminded me of, one of the things that annoyed Latin American leftists a great deal in the 50s and 60s, and probably to this day, but certainly at that time I well remember, the fact that in many instances Russian economic aid was particularly directed towards those Latin American countries which had fascist regimes. And in Colombia at that time, there was a dictator who, to the great infuriation and annoyance of the local communists, many of whom were in prison, was in receipt of considerable Russian economic aid. And right through the period when Nasser of Egypt was in close alliance with Russia, there too, most of the actual local Communist Party members were in prison. So you get these kind of seeming contradictions, but they're not so contradictory.
Has anybody got a question really directed towards the subject? Case against capitalism, case for socialism. Anyone's got any burning desire to make a comment?
Just got burning desires.
You're getting to the age where that sort of thing should be a pleasant.
Yes.
Colin Cook talked about possible use of computers in electronic warehouses and so on in socialism. The Socialist Party put forward the case for socialism since 1904. And although perhaps the theoretical case hasn't changed, would you agree, what are his comments on the practical case for socialism becoming easier and easier?
I think there are two parts to an answer to that. And the first part is that a socialist party which did not adjust its sights to the current situation would not be a socialist party worthy of the name. And that's to say, it is always the situation now. And this is, if you remember, one of the reasons why I tried to tie it down to the next 20 or 30 years, because, in fact, although I don't believe that there will be any major inventions in the next 50 or 60 years, it still makes sense to talk about it in terms that we know. And therefore, 1904 is one time, 1982 is another, and we must always talk about it in those terms. Yes, I do agree, this is the implicit thing, that it is easier to talk about it now, simply because the democratic aspect of it is much more demonstrable to people when you have those necessary facets of democracy. And those are really the ones I mentioned as being part of control. That's information, communication, and discussion. These are all essential to democracy. Now, while these are difficult because you have to do everything either by moving people around or by moving pieces of paper around, those democracy looks a difficult thing. Democracy in principle isn't a difficult thing, but it has been these physical limitations. And I think that the information revolution, if that's what it really is, but this betterment and so on, this improvement in the means of communication and information storage and retrieval and so on, have demonstrated much more clearly than it used to be the case that democracy is a thoroughly workable thing. And democracy in a much wider sense than simply sitting on committees, you know, I don't think that's
the last comment, Cooking, is talk about sympathy conditions for socialism to come about. And obviously, you went on saying that it won't come about overnight, so forth. Indeed, a mass amount of discussion going on. How does he equate that it'll be preconditions, but it'll be a mass amount of discussion on planning a socialist society?
Not sure I quite understand which is the bit you're trying to get at.
If I remember correctly, you said that.
Yeah, I certainly said that.
There has to be a transformation from capitalism to socialism.
Yeah.
There'll be certain things that will be done.
Yeah.
And when you get into a true socialist society, or a socialist society, then things will happen.
Yeah.
But surely there's a contradiction between what will be discussed beforehand and what will happen when you're a socialist society. Surely there's no need for preconditions and transition to socialism. When people are talking about it, they're going to plan about it, so therefore they're going to go straight into it.
Oh, well, this very much depends on how many of them there are.
Well, you talked about mass consciousness. And I equate mass consciousness with the majority of the population, which is, i.e., the working class. Not necessarily 90% of the working class, or 90% of the population which accounts to the working class at the present moment. 75% or whatever. But at the same time, why talk about a transition from a capitalist society and into a socialist society when you have mass consciousness?
I'll try to say again or expand a little bit on what I said, though I must admit I'm not quite sure of the point which bothers you. We are now talking to some extent about socialist society. We're discussing the way in which it will likely work. Nevertheless, there are not very many of us. Now, it seems to me that that is a process which will grow. But we can't now institute socialism. Many of the people who will start talking with us tomorrow, and the next day, and next year, and the next 5 years, will be drawn into that discussion. But it is, there is no such thing in human history as a sudden change. That doesn't exist. There is a point at which you can say the change took place, was critically determined or decided. But there is no such thing as a sudden change. There is no such thing as total ignorance of socialism today and total knowledge of it tomorrow. It must be a growth. The decisive act that the working class has got to take in this and every other country is to abolish capitalism. But at the point at which they do that, they will already know exactly what they're doing. They will already know exactly what they're going to do after it. That can only come about by the discussion before they take that act. The discussion, it won't be in a transition phase that's neither capitalism nor socialism. It will take place within capitalism.
So the discussion phase will take place within capitalism?
Must do. It hasn't, until the working class takes action about it, it will still be capitalism.
So therefore the planning will take place within capitalism?
Surely. And probably resisted by the capitalist class. Probably interfered with at all sorts of levels. There will be all sorts of alternative planning done. They'll put it on television, they'll say, no, that's just not really... If we get, you know, the old soapbox thing, as soon as you say we're coming in to take it over the bakery, they'll start throwing out bread, won't they? To try and stop you. And I would say that one of the biggest fears in any capitalist class's mind is a sizable socialist movement that is not talking about particularly how it's going to get rid of capitalism, because that's easy and simple while they're off, when they're all, but what it's going to put in its place. Wouldn't that be worrying?
Am I comment?
Yes, the speaker, Ron Cook, is speaking about the planning for socialism as if it's in the future, or that's how he has spoken about it. Because the planning for socialism is something that's going on in the present, and planning for socialism is something that's gone on for a long time, and all of the things which you are projecting into the future are happening now. The whole, the very fact that the concept of socialism itself has been stolen and abused by every single apologist for capitalism who wants to put up a radical facade is itself an indication of the fact that these people are scared of the idea of socialism because socialism is what is in line with what's happening at the moment. Socialism is what people have to think about if they're going to be thinking in terms of dealing with the current problems of social reality. And for example, you only have to take the alternative economic strategy. The alternative economic strategy borrows every form of socialism, the idea of planning, the idea of democracy, the idea of people being able to produce the use, and it perverts all of those concepts into the marketplace. Because if you listen to Dame Judith Hart summing up at the Labour Party conference, Comrade Dame, she said that what you have to do, she said, we're not in favour of a society where production is for profit. Oh, this is interesting. No, we're in favour of a society where production is for profit so that it can be used to satisfy people's needs. Well, because this is a kind of nonsense which you need to be able to understand. Become a Dane, probably, and to chair of this is your alternative economic strategy. And then, for example, you only have to look at the news, the television. You know, I get fed up. Every few so often, I bump into a member of the Socialist Party, and they say, did you see that programme on television last night? It lasted for 35 minutes, and the first 30 minutes of it were putting forward classical socialist ideas. I always say, yes, what happened in the last 5 minutes? And they say, oh, well, it wasn't so good. Because this is the way it happens. Because they want to do that. They can't go on television and talking about the way that they did in the past. Well, they can't educate us as we did. And when the person over here said about ideas travelling from one country to another, the best example of that I can think of is the ideas of Marx. Look at Karl Marx. They threw him out of every country he went to, except for this one. In this country, they tried to ban his works, they hold him in contempt, they tell people not to read them. You can walk into a bookshop and you find a massive array of books about why Marx was wrong, why Marx was irrelevant, why you shouldn't read anything about Marx. It's incredible that the bookshops are full of it. Because the fact of the matter is, they cannot stop it. You know, as Roy Jenkins said, you cannot stop an idea whose time has come. Well, it's not yet time for any ideas to come to him. In the case of Marxism, the idea of Marxism, well, you always hear people talk about Marxist militants, Marxist infiltrators, Marxist, you know, you'd think Marxism was a sort of construction outfit, the way they talk about it. But the fact of the matter is, all that Marxism is, what is it? A theory of history. What is the theory of history? That things constantly change, and that there is a process in history of class struggle. No one can deny that. Marxist theory of economics, what is it? That the rich are rich because they rob the poor. You can read 3 volumes about it, but it all amounts to that sentence. The rich are rich because they legally rob the poor through a process of the wages system. The Marxist argument is a theory of socialism. People have written volumes. What did Marx mean by socialism? Was it Russia? Was it Cuba? You know, perhaps it's somewhere in Venus or Jupiter. The fact of the matter is quite obvious. Socialism simply means common ownership, democratic control, production for use. Now, you can't argue about that. People come up and they say, what about the greedy man? What about the lazy man? What about the, you know, the man who's half greedy and half lazy? The man who gets up at 11:30 in the morning? The man who works night shifts 2 nights a week? The fact of the matter is, there are all these objections are a lot of absolute nonsense. When you ask people, you say, what is it? You know, they say, in a socialist society, yes, it's all very well, I agree with everything, but in a socialist society, what about if you produce too much bread and it goes stale? And you say, well, are you in favour of a socialist society? No. Well, never mind about the bread. That's the answer. If you want capitalism, then it's not just bread that's going stale, it's human dignity which goes stale, it's human lives, 2/3 of the world is starving. So in a socialist society, we can afford to produce a few loaves of bread that people don't consume. If it's a problem, I'll consume them. I started the planning. So I just say one thing in conclusion. Again, Ron Cook speaks, you know, very good stuff, I think, the kind of thing we should be saying about what socialist society requires. In terms of all the things that capitalism offers now. It says information systems. We've got information systems now. You may not know it. This is the year of what they call information technology. During the year of information technology, what information have I received? That a man broke into the Queen's bedroom. according to the information we've received from the psychiatric hospital, he was unwell. We all know that. What else would a man want to break into the Queen's bedroom? How much copper there is in Vietnam, which is the Americans knew all about, or if I want to know how much rice there is in China, or if I want to know how much wool there is in Yorkshire, I have to go along to Her Majesty's stationery office, and I have to pay more money than you'll get in the collection here tonight if you take it twice over. You cannot get the information. It's not available to the majority of us here. We don't know what there is in the world. Most of us haven't travelled around the world. You know, you travel to a beach on the other side of the world for what they call a holiday, and you may as well, you won't even know you're in a different country. It's the same, because they design all of these places to be uniform and the same. And so we don't know enough about the world. We don't know about society. Socialism isn't a problem. So what I want to say here, coming to him, is every person in this room tonight who is not a member of the Socialist Party should simply be a socialist. There's not any argument about it. We should stop the meeting now. We should go downstairs and have a drink. We don't need to argue about it. We don't need to debate about it. We can forget about it. All become socialists, and that's it. And then we make some more socialists.
I'll second that. Oh, no. Harry, yeah, well, I was going to make a contribution before Steve did. I've been preempted, if you like, to it's just on this question of it's a sort of controversy that we'll probably be discussing at our autumn delegate meeting, which begins tomorrow at 12 o'clock, I believe, that's the time, and Sunday. And it's a delegate conference to discuss what operations and propaganda the Socialist Party has done and will do in the future, and also to discuss relevant ideas. And at the moment there is a kind of a controversy. I don't know whether it would be called of major importance or not, but
On this question of what socialism will be like, there are quite a number of members that think that we should be concentrating more of our propaganda in that direction. Well, okay, those people who are capable of doing that, of getting all the statistics, and Comrade Coleman has assured us that this is almost impossible in certain cases under capitalism, nevertheless we'll be doing a good job of work. But what we have to bear in mind is that you can't start to think at all about what it's going to be like in socialism unless you become a socialist. And what we mean by that at the present time has got nothing really to do with whether or not we're going to have central planning or whether we're going to have the countryside organised with smaller units and there's going to be local autonomy and all the rest of it. What is important is that people understand the necessity for introducing a different system of society. And in order to do that, we've got to know in general what capitalism stands for and what it is and what socialism will achieve. And at the moment, of course, we are about 500 in the Socialist Party, and that is an indication of the number of socialists that are at least around in the United Kingdom. It may be a few more than 500, but it's not many more. And, you know, I think that the too much emphasis on this question of what socialism will be like is rather puerile, because you see, whilst you've only got 500 apparent socialists, there is no danger from the working class, or of the SPDB in particular, that the capitalist class have got to fear. It's only when there's an indication that the working class start to understand what their social position is that arguments and discussions about what will be done will become relevant. So what I'm saying is that, okay, let us all become socialists, as Comrade Coleman has indicated. This is the most important thing. And I would suggest that the most important question for us is to make as many socialists on that basis, rather than too much expenditure of our energy talking about what will occur when socialism arrives, which is, although I've heard it described, I've heard the proposition of the common ownership and democratic control and the production for use, I've heard that described in certain quarters as a gigantic abstraction. Nevertheless, it's necessary for the working class to come to grips with that gigantic abstraction, as it's so termed, and understand that what is absolutely necessary is an understanding of their class position, understanding of the fact that capitalism has nothing further to offer, and an understanding that what is going to be put in the place of capitalism is just that. Production for use, where the criterion would be from each according to his or her ability, to each according to his or her needs.
Seems to me as if all these, the present conditions, all these certain amount of people can understand what pure, sort of like, democratic socialism is. That's what I've been thinking, because I've been coming on to these meetings now for a month to 6 weeks, and I've been thinking, yeah, it sounds great. I'm convinced, but how are we going to convince the majority of people, you know, to sort of like get in their own mind individually to understand socialism? And I think, I start to think about all the different arguments, and I think, no, I don't think the majority will ever understand it under present conditions, and anything's going to change. And I start thinking about the SWP, the Communist Parties, and the dictatorship, to take them along with us. But then I know that's wrong, but...
One of the interesting things to me is that you assume that most members of the working class are more difficult to understand than you do. No?
Well,
it seems to me to be a matter of...
It's not that, it's the approach to them. Can we get through to them to give our message in the right conditions? I don't consider myself an elitist. Anyway.
There are a lot of times when, rather than members, I wouldn't say members of the SPGB, there are a lot of times when individual members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain may feel as you do. And there are times when some of them kid themselves for a moment that they will never get the working class to understand capitalism. I maintain that every member of the working class understands capitalism only too bloody well. The trouble is that for the best part of their time, most members of the working class don't want to know. Do you like living with the fact that you are a wage prostitute? Do people like knowing that? That they have got to go and sell themselves, whether they like it or not. This is one of the big obstacles. That the sort of thing that we are telling the working class knows in its bones, and it's known it for a bloody long time. They know, whether they can give you the figures or not, they know that they're being milked. That's why would they be there? They know that damn well. They know that capitalism will probably kill them. It'll either kill them with stress ailments or an industrial accident or the next war. They know that. They know it's a dangerous system. They know all the things that we rail against. We can give them more facts. We can tie the arguments together perhaps a bit better because we produce literature and so on, but we're not telling them anything new. What the working class as a whole has not got is a belief that there is an alternative. They don't at the moment believe it. And the reason they don't believe it is because capitalism spends a hell of a lot of money persuading them that it isn't possible. So your job, and the job of every socialist, is to show them first that they've got the strength, that though they may be one, they're one and one and one and one and one until they're the majority of the population. That's the first thing they've got to learn. The second thing they've got to learn is what the alternative is. Now, you can, I'm sorry to disagree with Harry, you can reel the formula off. A system of common ownership, production for use, but that abstraction, what does it mean? What's it going to be like? Is it a viable alternative to capitalism which they have known all their childhood, all their adult life? Does it make sense or is it pie in the sky? Now, I think socialists should show them that it is not only a matter of common sense, it is also an inevitable part of the development of the technology in capitalism, that in fact it's not a totally separate thing, like heaven, that it's a development of human society and what human society does. And that most of the developments have already taken place. The one that hasn't taken place is the crucial one, the political one. The working class actually taking over all these things that they've produced, that they've invented, that they've constructed. They've done the bloody lot. They've laid all the groundwork for socialism. Everything that the socialist society needs is there in potential. The agriculture can be boosted up tomorrow. They've got to start putting acres into production again that governments have paid to keep out and all the rest of it. They've got to stop piling up their butter and they've got to feed it to people. They've got to stop burning wheat as they used to do and send it to people, all of these things. But, you know, everything is there except the thing that you raise, except working class awareness, consciousness and willingness. Now, you're the agent of this. Is it possible? Do you believe it?
Yeah.
Is it? What you've got to communicate. Not the facts in the end.
Really to say, the only thing that I can say is reply to this question, if he can understand it, I don't see why, you know, they can presume that others can't understand it. As Ron says, there's no doubt about it, if you work on a factory on the shop floor, people do know that there's something wrong. They don't know what's wrong, but they know there's a feeling of resentment.
there's a whole different attitude in people on the shop floor now to what was when I was a young man. There's a whole different outlook in people. You don't hear the same sort of questions at socialist meetings that you used to hear. People are better informed today, despite what. You know, some people may think they're better informed, they're more aware, they're looking for something. If there is a slogan that the SPGB should adopt, and it's not an organisation that's given to slogans, it is grow, grow. And the only way you grow, the only way you change the world, is by getting out and, you know, working to do that. There's whole areas where we are not getting to. Whole areas. And when we go to them, I believe that we're well received. I had a wonderful experience at Stoke. Like a nowhere, literally. Like a nowhere. You know, a wonderful meeting. A wonderful meeting. And, I mean, the sort of thing, I'm quite certain that if we were to go to many places like this, where we've never done little or nothing, that we could have this reception. I think that today, more than ever, people are thinking, people are wondering. They're being got over by the bloody scruff of the neck and shaken, really shaken. They say, what's going on? Why? What for? And I think that if the socialist is there, well, then he can provide some of the answers. If there's anything this movement is lacking, and I don't like to look backward, is the visions that used to be in the people like Trestle and the Morrises and that, the visions of what they used to term as the New Jerusalem. We need more of that. We need more of the missionaries like the Chartists had. You know, to get about and tell people about it. And I think this is so important. I think it is so important. Because I believe that where we go, we're well received. We're well received. I'm quite convinced of it. And I think this is the sort of thing that we've got to do. I.e., if we want to change the world, we've got to